Yeah, we don't want all boys on one side.
Perception is reality.
Good evening. There.
All right.
What did you? All right. We're good. It's a psychomotor skill, I'm sure. Good evening. This is the September meeting of the Health Commission, and this meeting is now called to order. First order of business will be the approval of the minutes of our last meeting on August 13th. Are there any corrections or changes, additions to the minutes that have been sent out to you? There being no corrections or additions to the minutes, I'll entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
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 Minutes are approved, and we'll move to the next item on the agenda, and that being the public comment. At this time, anybody who would like to come forward and make a comment on an item that is not on the agenda, you may do so for 3 minutes. When you do come forward, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Enns. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria, and I just learned a good piece of news this evening from Sarah Horn that indeed Avila Valley Barn is labeling its genetically engineered corn, so we're making progress. Of course, as she pointed out, there's no law saying he has to. I think it would be better if it were required, but we'll take what we can get. On that subject, I would again request that your commission would follow the lead of Greg Thomas, Dr. Greg Thomas, the health officer, who is in favor of labeling, and that this body also take an official position in favor of labeling of genetically engineered crops, and pass that motion on to our Board of Supervisors. I'd also like to bring to your attention there's a new book out called Genetic Roulette, the Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods by Jeffrey M. Smith. And on the subject of BT, I've been talking a lot about BT corn. Some of you may know that organic growers get to use BT because it's a naturally occurring, it comes from a bacteria that occurs naturally in the soil, and they're permitted to use BT as a spray. And the reason for that is it degrades rapidly in the environment. The sun degrades it. Plus, before you eat your produce, you can easily wash it off. So there's no chance that you're going to be harmed by BT used by an organic grower. But it has been documented that if you did have exposure to that form of BT, you could suffer allergy problems. And then the problem with, of course, engineering it into the corn, then it's on duty full time. You can't wash it off. Plus, in the process of engineering it in, they found a way to increase the potency. So it might be 10 times more potent in the form that it's found in the corn as opposed to spraying it on. So I just thought you might want to know that little angle in case you find out, oh, organic gardeners are using BT. How come they're objecting to genetic engineers using it? So I hope I've made that point clear to you. So thanks again. I am sorry to see the commission isn't at full strength tonight, but thank you all for being here and listening. And please, once again, I hope you will support mandatory labeling of genetically engineered crops. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Arnold. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I'll begin by saying I agree with the previous speaker. I think people should be able to know and be informed about what they're getting. The other topic I wanted to raise for you, since we are in a drought year, which may, depending on the coming rainy season, turn into a drought period. We all hope it doesn't. There are beginning to be areas in the county that where wells are failing and they're getting water delivered by trucks. And I've been asked by people in those neighborhoods whether the county has any process to inspect the or treat or anything the water that goes into trucks and gets carted out to various neighborhoods. And I did not have a ready answer, and I figured this would be a good place to get the answer. I would suggest that you agendize this question for the next session. If the answer is reassuring, then it can be delivered as part of health department updates. Whoever from environmental health can describe the process by which we make sure that water delivered in trucks to neighborhoods and outlying areas is potable and meets all health requirements. If the answer is not reassuring, then I would suggest you make it an action agenda item so you can raise that concern with our county supervisors and get some such process in place. But as I say, people are wondering where this water miraculously comes from when it's delivered by truck, and I would hope you can find out. Thank you.
Commissioner Hetherington has a question for you, Mr. Greening.
Some of the outlying areas in the North County, it's not urbanized areas right now. It's more sort of the scattered areas that you could say were unwisely subdivided from or within agricultural lands where people are living a residential lifestyle out there.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else who would like to make a comment? Doesn't appear that there are. Is. So we'll move on now to the first item on our agenda of tonight's theme. And I'd like to welcome Jan Campbell, and she will be giving us a presentation on perinatal substance use and on the four Ps. So welcome, Jan. Thank you very much for being here.
You're very welcome, and thank you, commissioners, for inviting me to come and share this information with you. Beginnings, and you know, when I was preparing this, I thought most of you know what Beginnings is, but looking at some of you, I don't recognize some of you, so this may be new to you, so I may have to do a little more explaining than what I have on my slides. But do you want to start that, Gene, or do I have a thing to push?
Okay.
So what do I push here?
Oh, first mouse button.
Here? Oh, there. Okay.
No, actually, first mouse button. Okay.
Oh.
Put it down on the table.
Gotcha.
Pull it like a mouse.
I'm not
there
technically.
Go ahead and let's switch out
the
heads right here.
Sorry. I'm glad I won't be staring at myself the whole presentation. Beginnings is a group. It's a collaborative of many private and public entities that we've brought together. We've been together for about almost 4 years. Beginnings came about when a group of us got together to do a perinatal leadership team to look at developing a scope of work for our county to look at women prenatally that were using alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. And so we put together a program along with Dr. Chasnoff and brought back to our county to implement in December of 2003. And from that came Beginnings. The program that we put together were the Four Ps Plus, which I will talk about after Beginnings here. And that's a program that assesses women prenatally for the drugs that I had just mentioned. Beginnings came about when we all came together and said we not only want to look at private providers, but we want to look at the community and how we get the message out to the community that it is not something that we want pregnant women to do using tobacco, alcohol, or any other drug during pregnancy. So that's where Beginnings came from. The vision for Beginnings was a vision that we got from our children's leadership team that San Luis Obispo County will be a community where every child is born free of the effects of alcohol, tobacco, and drug exposure, and lives in a home that promotes healthy growth and development. That's a big vision to fulfill, but we're on our way. I think when you see the results of the 4Ps, you'll be very, very pleased. One of the big things that we target in beginnings is alcohol. And as you see in the end of the presentation, you'll see that alcohol is our number one drug of choice in this county. And it's probably the worst drug you can use prenatally. So we really have our work cut out for us because it's such an acceptable drug. I've always said that if you saw a woman drinking a glass of wine, probably none of us would even think twice about it. But if we saw her snorting cocaine off the table, we'd be appalled. And wine is definitely, with the alcohol, much more severe for the fetus. So we do have a lot of work to do there. We know that alcohol exposure is a leading preventable cause of birth defects. And I didn't put this slide in, but when you look at birth defects, spina bifida, Down syndrome, even HIV, FAS, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, is 10 to 12 times more as far as a percentage of birth defects than any other birth defect that we have with our children. So it is a problem that we need to address. The foundational beliefs for beginnings, substance abuse is a chronic and relapsing disease that interferes with healthy functioning of families. Any substance use during pregnancy is potentially harmful. And this is one that we even, with our providers in the area, have really had to struggle with. Many people feel that the use of alcohol and marijuana moderately during pregnancy is okay. And also even in our textbooks for our physicians in medical school, most of the textbooks will say that moderation in these areas is okay. And we know that research has shown that it's not. And we're really playing Russian roulette with our children when we take these substances into our system. We don't know. There are many things that affect children, their whole genetic makeup. There can be twins that one has FAS and the other one does not. So there are a lot characteristics and things that play into how children react to this. So our message to physicians and to pregnant women is absolutely no drug use, and especially alcohol during pregnancy. Cessation of substances used at any point in pregnancy is beneficial. We're finding that the brain develops in pregnancy about 5 weeks. And most of us don't know that we're pregnant till about 6 or 8 weeks. So when we're taking in substances, we've already done some damage to the fetus. But we also know that it's in the third trimester that mental retardation sets in. So even if women have drank in the first trimester, we need to get the message out to them that you need to stop because it's going to affect the IQ of your child if you continue to do this through pregnancy. Children need to be in a stable home free from substance abuse for healthy growth and development. And research has shown definitely that children, even if they've been exposed prenatally, if they're left in the home, the damage can be very severe. So intervening for these children is something that we really need to make sure that we do. So we not only have the perinatal end that we work prenatally to get them off of drugs, but you'll hear from Dr. Hollifield later that we now have opened an assessment center here in San Luis called Martha's Place that provides interventions for those children after they're born. Quality treatment works when we intervene. We have a intervention called I'm Concerned, and it's a brief intervention that we provide all of these tools for our providers in San Luis Obispo. And this intervention is done in the office with the pregnant women. And research has shown that a brief intervention is just about as successful as actually going into a full-fledged program. So we know that this is working, and as you see at the end of my presentation, you'll see the results that we've had so far in the last almost 4 years. First Five has given Beginnings a grant that they have given us $100,000 over the next 2 years to really work on community education. And some of the things that we're doing, we have a website up, and the website address is there for you, and I would welcome you all to go to that website. It is a very, very good website. We're still working on it, but it has lots of different links to information for people who are interested in getting information about prenatal substance use during pregnancy. And then we also have a very interactive site on there where we have actually interviewed high school and college age kids and had them doing some presentations on the use of tobacco and alcohol and other drugs during pregnancy. So it's a great site to go and get information on the whole use. And it also does give information about the 4 P's and assessments. And we have some films on there that they can actually click on and look at the use of alcohol during pregnancy. This is the website. I couldn't get it all on there, but you can see at the top it has lots of, you know, frequently asked questions, events that are going on within the community, and then it breaks down specifically to alcohol and other drugs that you can go specifically to get information on those issues. We have decided to adopt a campaign that was started in Riverside, California through the ARC, which is a program that deals with children that have disabilities. And it's called 9-0 Campaign, and it's 9 months, zero alcohol. This campaign has been very, very successful in Riverside, and in fact, they just received a grant from the CDC to actually promote this campaign statewide, and I happen to be on the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder State Task Force, and we're working on what we want this to look like. And my goal is that anybody can go onto 9-0 site and download any information, any curriculum, any posters, anything for free, putting their own information on it for their county and use it. And that's our goal for this. We've gotten permission to use a 9-0 campaign. It is copyrighted, but we've gotten permission for this county to use it. So we'll be using this with San Luis Obispo County information on it to target our population that is using alcohol during pregnancy. The 4 P's. This is a program that we implemented in December of 2003. We are in almost every OB office in our county. There's only a couple that we're not in, and those two don't do a lot of deliveries. So it's not that there are a lot of women that we're missing. And this is a screening program that goes through these four areas of parents, partner, past, and pregnancy as far as use of alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. And when we go through and ask these questions, it's really the pregnancy that we're looking at to get a positive 4 P's for us. So when you look at later on, look at the data that we have collected, when I say that are positive, that means a woman has either used, for us, marijuana, tobacco, or alcohol in the month before she knew she was pregnant. That's a positive 4 P's. When they get a positive 4 P's, we then go down and ask 4 more questions, and we're really wanting to get the information. What are you using? How often do you use it? So we're collecting all that information. One of the things in our county, as I had said earlier, alcohol is our number one drug of choice. And unfortunately, we have a lot of women that continue to use even after they know that they are pregnant. That percentage has dropped, but we're about at the 24% with women who are continuing to use. So we still have a lot of children that are being exposed in our county. These are the core interventions for our 4-P's Plus. We screen with the 4-P's Plus tools. We assess them. Then we refer them. Our Department of Drug and Alcohol has worked very closely with us in this program, expanding their program that is gender specific for pregnant and parenting women in this county. And they expanded that to all areas of the county, North, San Luis, and South, and have gone from 3 to 5 days a week that they will see women. And pregnant women have priority over anyone to get into these programs. And last I checked, there is no waiting list, so it's a good program for pregnant women. I will have to say we're about the same as the national rate for women who actually will accept a referral into a program. We're about 6%. So we don't have a huge amount of women that are saying, I have a problem. I want to get into drug and alcohol. But we are reaching every woman with our I'm Concerned brief treatment program that we do in the offices. And that is making a difference. And I think we're making a really big difference in that group I call the AHA group. It's I didn't know. And we have a lot of I didn't know in this county. So I think it's our obligation to make sure that they have all the information to make the best decision for their child and themselves during pregnancy. This is where we're at. 32% of the women that are testing positive or assessing positive for the 4-P's plus, it is for the use of alcohol. And we all know that for the most part, alcohol probably is one of the drugs that you can say they probably aren't using other drugs with that. But when you start getting down to marijuana, tobacco, illicit drugs, you can probably bet that they're also using alcohol with those other drugs. So alcohol is a huge problem for us to really address. This is where we're at today. And when I did this, it really made me feel good to visually see what we've done. We started in 2003. We were at about 51% of the women that we did assessing on had used either tobacco or alcohol in the first trimester. We have now dropped down to about 27%, which is, I mean, that's almost half. I mean, it really makes me feel good that the last 4 years, we are making a difference with the women in our county. We are getting the message out that no alcohol, no tobacco, no drug during pregnancy is really, really important. And we have our providers now saying that, which has really been great. That is the end of my presentation. If you have any questions about the program.
Commissioner Hetherington. Thanks, Jan.
You're welcome.
You work with the prenatal doctors. You work with outreach. Do you do any outreach in the wineries? I mean, here we have this cash crop that brings in a lot of money in the county that everybody puts on a pedestal, yet we have this problem. Is there outreach in the vineyards? I mean, is there anybody that's willing to put a sign, we don't serve pregnant women?
Not at this point. We approached the wineries in 2004. And first of all, they didn't want to be connected with tobacco or drug at all. So that's really one of the reasons we're pulling out alcohol to speak at its own. Because for me, when you start looking at putting all of those together, if I were using any of those, I'd probably say, I don't do alcohol and I don't do tobacco, so I'm okay. So we really need to speak to each drug on its own. We are working very hard trying to get into some of the wineries, and we're trying to maybe go through the Vintners Association instead of going to individual wineries. There are some wineries in Northern California that do have some campaigns that are telling women not to drink during pregnancy. And how we're looking at the wineries is to actually go in and say, would you put a sign up that said, if you're pregnant or think you could be pregnant, ask us for our complimentary and whatever they're going to give. That's a statement that says, if you're pregnant, we don't want you drinking. But it says it in a very nice, subtle way so that they're not, coming around and refusing to serve women. So, but we don't have any takers yet, and it's something that we're not giving up, and that's one thing that Beginnings is working on, is we have a couple of inns with some wineries, and so we're trying to set up appointments to see if we can't get them to back us up on this. That's a huge step. My thing, we have a through the MCH directors statewide, we have a lobbyist that we work with on a lot of bills and things that are up there through, it's not related to any county stuff. This is through an organization. And I talked to her about actually doing what they're doing with the pharmaceuticals. I don't know if any of you, I mean, when you see those pharmaceutical ads, I don't think I ever want to take anything after they told me all the things that could happen to me if I did. But I think it would be very simple to be able to put at the end of a Smirnoff or Coors or Bud's a commercial at the end, if you're pregnant or think you could be pregnant, do not take this, and just do it at the bottom. But we have a huge lobbyist for alcohol, huge. And so it took us a long time with tobacco, but there's no reason why we can't work with the alcohol industry.
Are there any other questions from commissioners for Jan? Are there any questions from the audience? Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Really appreciate your efforts and what you're doing. It's great. All right, we will move along then to our next presenter, which is Dr. Joseph Hollifeld from Martha's Place. Welcome, Dr. Hollifeld. Thank you for being here.
Make sure I get the clicker. It's like at home I have to wrestle this from my children a lot, so. On behalf of the clinical team at Martha's Place, I want to thank the Health Commission for their invitation to speak tonight. Go ahead and kind of just a quick overview of the development of Martha's Place. It's interesting, there's a connection with Jan's work with the 4Ps Plus and the and Beginnings. A lot of their data was used as a potential needs assessment. If a lot of these people are having difficult, or admitting to using alcohol, then you have to think about from a developmental continuum, from a prenatal standpoint, that eventually children will be born with exposure. So, with the help of Shirley Bianchi and yes,
the laser pointer doesn't work well on television.
It doesn't. Okay.
If you could use the mouse, the cursor will appear.
Oh, okay. The mouse, right?
Yeah, just stay down on the ground.
Okay. Oh, now I've bumped this.
All right. But the laser pointer won't be effective.
Okay. Thanks.
The only one that sees is you.
Okay. So I'm just using right here?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I can just go ahead and talk from that and point that out. The needs assessment was based on the 4Ps Plus data, and then there was some grassroots movement through with Shirley Bianchi, Biz Steinberg, EOC, and Jan Campbell. We're very active in trying to get a children's assessment center to look at these issues. What was developed from that was a children's leadership team that worked with Dr. Chasnoff back in at Children's Research Triangle in Chicago. And it's really, it's a great community partnership of EOC, mental health services, public health, social services, Tri-Counties, the SLO County SELPA. Really working together to try to look and see what the potential issues might be from a 0 to 5 standpoint. We've had support from Dr. Chasnoff at Children's Research Triangle, specifically with consultation training, program development, and program evaluation. I think wanted to go back to the multi-agency partnership is really that it's really unique in that it's a model of practice and a community response to the problem. And this is rare. I found this when I went to the 0 to 3 National Conference in Albuquerque this past year, where looking at a lot of mental health issues, medical response issues from a national standpoint, and when I talked with people about what people were doing in Utah or New York City, and I told them about what we were doing here in this county, like, how'd you make that happen? How'd that work? And I was like, I wish I could have taken credit for that, but I didn't. I kind of explained how this community worked together to make this a reality. We have funding support from the Board of Supervisors, First Five, and the Community Foundation. They've been very supportive. And we just moved into our clinic in January of 07. Our model is a transdisciplinary model, and what that means is it's not hierarchical. We all have equal input from different professionals. I'm a clinical psychologist and a school psychologist. We have a public health nurse who gets really good records, does a lot of case management, has contacts with the families. We have a pediatrician who's been working with Dr. Chasnoff, and we do specialty examinations related to potential fetal alcohol spectrum issues and exposure and other drugs from a medical perspective. The clinical psychologist will do the developmental assessments, will do the cognitive assessments, the other psychological testing as needed. The school psychologist, we have a school psychologist consultant who works with us and will go and do preschool observations, which will get another area of observation besides in the clinic. So we get more of an ecological approach to this, as well as the infant mental health therapist who also, they go and do home interviews, get a sense of what the home environment's like. Again, another ecological perspective. So we're triangulating clinic, school, home. And then what we do is the mental health therapist, everybody writes up sections of the report, and we meet as a team to look at what the diagnostic and treatment recommendations might be. And then we don't fully keep all the children. We try to look for treatment providers in the community that might be able to address the issues. We only have at this time 1.75 mental health therapists, so we can't fully address all the community's needs at this time. But I just want to run down the numbers. So far to date, and this has actually gone up, it's by 10 people since the last time I checked the data. I checked it today. But on this, we've seen 96 children have come through. We haven't seen all of them. What we do is we triage and see if they kind of fit our approach, which is pretty much 0 to 5, possibility of prenatal exposure or high-risk behaviors that might be associated with prenatal exposure to alcohol or drugs. So sometimes you don't know whether it's suspected or confirmed of exposure. You have to go, at least from the children's angle, possible to high-risk behaviors. We've already got some more psychological assessments scheduled for September. We're looking in October. The referrals actually have gone up. We had 20 referrals in August, and we're seeing 14 children for direct therapy, attachment-based therapy, relating to and behavioral therapy related to attachment issues. And we're organizing two attachment-based groups in partnership with Drug and Alcohol Services POG program. And this is more with the biological parents that, of children seen individually at Martha's Place. So we're trying to work on attachment issues and kind of some of the issues around the parents' own use and attachment. So we're kind of working on that model. And it's really going to be kind of, excuse me, what we're going to try to do is look at different data points throughout therapy and see how the parents are responding to that. This is kind of based on the data of the children we've seen. And the percentage of polysubstance exposure by number of combined substances. And if you look right there at two substances, 52% of the children that have come through here that we've seen have been exposed to at least two substances. And then you have 26% three substances, 19% four substances. This just makes things from a diagnostic and intervention standpoint complex, because typically with diagnostics we try to look at etiology or cause. Well, there's a lot of things that are going on with our kids. We have not only polysubstance exposure, but we have removal from the home, domestic violence exposure, trauma issues that also can look like behaviors related to prenatal exposure. So nonetheless, trying to look at a specific cause per se makes it a little bit more difficult. What I did here is, now given the polysubstance exposure issue, and I put up there a note, a child may have had multiple exposures given the previous slide, but if I could break it down into the most frequently occurring substance, it's methamphetamine of the kids we're seeing, as opposed to alcohol, which is 26%, which differs from Jan's data. And so what's going on? You know, I think there's more questions that come up. What are we seeing that's different from what the prenatal SART's seeing? I think this is, it's more questions, and I'm a more of a research person myself, and so much, what hypothesis can we glean from this? Marijuana and nicotine are also at a different levels in that. Other drugs pretty much would be drugs like OxyContin, or something where there's more of a prescription dependency. And psychotropic medications, some parents have, or it's in the record that they've used like SSRIs or something. So, frequency of referral concerns. So not only do we have to look at the medical piece of it, the substance exposure, you have to look at the behavioral presentations. Why are kids being referred? And if you look over the far left, 35%, we label that as medical, and really that's more of the exposure related. So you're thinking more in terms of neurological potential here of kids that we know that have been exposed prenatally. There's the likelihood that there might be some neurological effects. So we do a medical exam around that. The next highest is behavioral aggression, followed by hyperactivity being one of the main reasons or possible reasons why a kid was referred to our center, and then tantrums and meltdowns. And when you look at the data, it's the aggression piece really falls in line with the potential of what, you know, methane exposure might be. We don't know a whole lot in the research about what the developmental outcomes of meth exposure is, because it's just hard to research. It's hard to control that type of research data. But, you know, we can surmise that that might be part of it, as well as the alcohol. So we don't really know, or the trauma. So it goes back to the diagnostic complexity. So what are we seeing? What's happening besides just the behavioral referral presentations? You know, some of the in just the few months we've been working with children in the 0-5 population, we've seen several cases on kids that have failure to thrive, some neurological issues, the motor control, significant emotional control difficulties. So really, emotional arousal state regulation issues, which kind of ties into the research with FAS spectrum disorders, as well as what you would see from cocaine exposure. And so there's some questions, at least in the research, whether cocaine and meth kind of have similar properties. You know, are we seeing that kind of piece with the meth that's similar to cocaine? Again, I don't know the specific answer, but it's something that kind of raises a clinical question. Domestic and violence exposure, we're seeing that. Reason kids have been removed from the homes, and they come, and we'll look at that. And then we have the attachment difficulties that kids are having related to, you know, we're looking at a very critical time in child development. You know, the 0-5 population, where especially even younger, infants and toddlers, attachment is key. And, you know, we're seeing kids being removed from homes. Also, they've been prenatally exposed, so they have the state regulation difficulties on top of the inattention difficulties, and now they're having to attach to different caregivers at the same time. And so it's layers of complexity. And, yes, even though it's rare in the research and so forth, and even my own clinical experience, we've had a few kids, and at least at the, you know, the five-year-old level, that have had some suicidal ideation, and one even had a plan. And that's, you know, for me as a clinician, it's hard to grasp. But we're looking at it from issues of there's some kids that are really, given their neurological difficulties, their difficulties with regulating their behavior, the attachment piece, they're starting to recognize from a self-awareness standpoint through peer feedback that they might have be in a helpless or hopeless situation. So we're trying to work on that, not either with us therapeutically or with community providers. Despite all this, we're also seeing a lot of resiliency, which has been great. We've seen some really wonderful toddlers. We've assessed some situations where the histories have just been horrific. But for some reason, there's resiliency. And it's been great to see. There's been individual developmental resiliency. We've seen a lot of foster parents who've been really good caregivers, providing nurturing, supporting environments. And it's been our experience. We've had some really good foster parents that have been working well with these kids in difficult situations, that kids that present with these issues. But I think what's encouraging is that, given the resiliency piece, that shows that genetics or prenatal exposure isn't destiny. It's more of an at-risk issue that needs to be monitored over time. Because even though we're not seeing difficulties at 12 months, 14 months, 2 years of age, when kids start to hit preschool, you start getting into social interactions. And so now that might present with different difficulties that we have to monitor. Treatment capacity. I think one of the biggest questions is, does the community have the right number of treatment personnel to meet the future needs of children who will need treatment for exposure issues? And at this time, no. This has a significant impact on Martha's Place. And really, if you think about it from a bottleneck issue, we have our center, we're getting referrals coming in, our mental health therapists participate in the intakes and the assessment process. We get kids in through an assessment. Then we don't have enough treatment providers in the 0 to 5 population and community to refer out for treatment. And so some of them come back to our center, which we do treatment. You know, we're primarily assessment center, but we also do treatment as well. We're doing a lot of, we're doing more treatment. And so really I think the bigger issue for the community is really trying to get infant mental health providers that can provide more play-based therapy, other services like occupational therapy and so forth to deal with some of the sensory issues that the kids need. The experience with older children has only highlighted this issue. There's been a community push, phone calls, talking to other people for us to assess older children. And right now, our scope is 0 to 5. I think it's more of a question of the community. If you look at it, from a developmental perspective in this community, we've done prenatal needs assessment that's led to a children's need, 0 to 5 needs assessment. The question becomes, where are the children in the community that are experiencing these issues from the 6 to 18 group? Where are they getting services? Are they getting services? Are they in special education? Are they receiving mental health? Are they at Tri-County's regional center? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's something that we have to grapple with, because really if you look at it from a developmental perspective, when we talk about developmental psychopathology, which is the study of disorders and mental health disorders in childhood, is that you start with prenatal, the children are born, and then there's the interaction between the biological child and the environment, and it's a transactional development. There's constant interaction. And depending on where you intervene in development, intervention at one early stage is prevention for potential development of or emergence of different disorders in adolescence and adulthood. So the work that 4Ps Plus and McGinnings, what they're doing is, even though it's intervention at that stage, it's prevention for us at Martha's Place. Hopefully what we're doing at 0 to 5, even though it's intervention from 0 to 5, is hopefully prevention for adolescents, for, either reducing the intensity of behavioral presentation, or hopefully, there's never really a cure, but hopefully reducing the amount of the presentation or giving the child and the family skills to cope with what the difficulties are. And then if we know where the kids are in the older population, what kinds of services are already available that we can enhance and get further training for the community providers, or what services are necessary to provide a unique assessment and treatment approach to these issues, similar to what Martha's Place is trying to do for the 0 to 5 population. What's been our impact so far? Well, we've been around pretty much a year ago. I was working in a cubicle and I had a folder and said, here's Martha's Place. Here's the paperwork. Let's get it going. And we started seeing clients probably in November of last year. Tri-County's let us use some of their space because our facility wasn't ready. We moved in January. And it's been a startup project, like any startup project. And we're not even, haven't really been fully seeing clients for a year yet. But the initial feedback from community providers and caregivers has been positive regarding our clinical work, coming from a mental health therapist about our reports. Some school districts have given us some positive feedback. Parents and caregivers, I've had some parents, biological parents, come in and thank us for helping them with the process and helping them better understand their children. We had our first therapy graduate about 3 weeks ago from one of our play-based therapy interventions, and she got a little certificate, but it was good. And then that's pretty much it's been, we're breaking new ground in the community. I think these types of what we're doing, this model, is actually rare in the state and rare in the country. And so we're still trying to figure it out, but I think it's a good start. So, are there any questions or comments?
Thank you. Commissioner Odell.
Which one do I punch now? To get
You've
on?
Got it. I can hear
it's
you.
It's live? Oh, okay. Well, my question is, have you had any children referred to you that have not had been exposed to any of the indices that you have indicated?
Any of the what?
Indices, or have not been exposed to any of the drugs or alcohol. Have you had children?
Yes, we have. And a lot of it's been more, you know, I haven't broken it down per se, but, you know, some of it has been we've had kids just referred for behavioral issues, you know, like emotional regulation or aggression. And so it's not just prenatal exposure. That's one of the criteria. It's prenatal exposure, 0 to 5, or high-risk behaviors. So we focus on the behavioral presentation because a lot of times we don't know in the record whether it's confirmed or suspected. We have to go. We don't have that information, so we have to go on the behavioral presentation.
So you treat them the same then?
Yeah, we have to look at it from a, we have to keep an open lens on kind of, and we don't assume exposure whenever we see a child. We just base it on what the information we have. We gather the information that's available, medical, psychological, and we go from there. So that's a good question.
Thank you.
I have a question. You said that there was a sort of a lack of providers for you to refer out to. Is that because there's a lack of the actual providers, or is there a lack of providers who are willing to take these referrals? And on top of that question is, who pays for this when you do refer them out?
Right. Well, right now, we've, you know, kind of the stages of development for, and it's been done in other communities this way, is we've started with Medi-Cal. We're pretty much a Medi-Cal provider at this time. We're starting to work into kind of a system of how we would incorporate, look at private pay versus other types of sources. So pretty much we're Medi-Cal. That's a lot of the kids we see are coming from foster care, drug and alcohol services, and EOC. But, you know, we're looking with tri-counties as well. We're starting to talk about interacting with them through, you know, we're going to potentially have an intake coordinator, early start intake coordinator. We're working with them to try to see if we can get them there one day a week so we can streamline services. The other question I think you were asking me was the population. And when I was at the Infant Development Association conference in San Jose this past spring, and this is a state association, but it's a really good national association, the whole focus was infant mental health. And there's a workforce capacity issue in infant mental health. I mean, infant mental health, for lack of a better pun, is in its infancy. You know, we don't, people have never thought about mental health issues in infancy, toddlerhood, and preschool. Yet we know attachment is a core base issue for emotional development. So I'm not, and even myself, I mean, you know, I've worked with preschools and preschool children and done clinical assessments and done some things as a clinical psychologist and work therapeutically with kindergartners and so forth. But when you really start looking at infants, it's more about that mother or caregiver dyad, the interaction between the infant, the toddler, and the child. And there's not a lot of training on that, or not a lot of programs for that. So the state's really trying to focus on that, and they've set guidelines for that. And it's a hard, if you think about it from a mental health standpoint, most of us are trained in talk therapy. Well, it's kind of hard to work with you know, someone in therapy when they're just developing language skills. I think it goes to the whole point of, you know, being familiar with play-based therapy, those type of issues, and I don't know how much the focus has been on 0 to 5 in that issue. We've got two good therapists. We found some therapists in the community that can work with them. I think it's what we're going to try to do is try to get, as I'm working with mental health and some other agencies, to try to get more training here for the community, to have community providers get trained who want to seek that training for 0 to 5 interventions from a mental health perspective. That's a good question.
So now I have another question.
Okay.
The attachment-based disorders, you would have to work with both the parent or the whoever was providing the parental services. I mean, if there's no one to attach to, how can you remedy that?
That's a good question.
Without, yeah.
I mean, I think it's really kind of looking at it from various aspects of the child. If you think from Bronfenbrenner's ecological validity standpoint, you look at the child, you think of nesting eggs, and you think of the child and then the interaction with the next nesting egg is interaction with the core family around that, the supporters, and the next nesting egg is the doctors, the school districts, and these layers of interaction and systems. And we really have, you know, the focus has really been in psychology and mental health and for the longest time on adolescents, adults, you know, older school age, and we really haven't looked as what can we do in interventions with 0 to 5, and what we're starting to find out is we can do a lot. But it's not just a San Luis Obispo County issue. It's a national and state issue, what we're finding. I mean, one of the providers that was at 0 to 3, the national conference, was a clinical psychologist who was asked to be director of a new children's clinic that services kids from 3 to 12. And that was for a 3-county region in another state. And he's an adult psychologist. And he was coming back to figure out, what do we do for intervention for this population? And so he's like, I'm a little perplexed and trying, and I need to do my own research to figure out what are the guidelines, what are the techniques, how do we diagnose issues from a 0 to 5 standpoint. And even our diagnostic models aren't set up to meet the needs of the 0 to 5 population, but they're working on it. So it's a loaded question, but I hope I answered it the best I could.
Well, it sounds like you have a long way to go, but you've got a really good start. So if there are no other questions, then I thank you very much for being here. I guess the only other thing that I might say, and I should have asked Jan this before she left the podium, is there any way the Health Commission can be helpful to what you're doing?
You know, that's a very good question, you know, this is my first time to present, and I think I need to learn more about what myself as a director, about what the needs are, but that's something we can bring up at our oversight committee about what are some of the community resources that are available and how can we work together. But I think that's a great offer, and that's something I'd like to continue to try to collaborate with the commission and developing that. But, I'd be happy to. I can't think off the top of my head right now, but... I think further contact would be a good idea.
Well, if you get a flash of brilliance, let us know. It appears there's some questions from the audience. So go ahead and come forward, Mr. Greening.
Eric Greening, and I appreciate this too, and I know it meant a lot to Shirley when she was on the board, and I'm glad to know this is off to a good start. My question, obviously, when you're talking about substances, you're talking about substances people choose or are in an addiction situation that they take into their body knowingly, with some degree of knowingness. My question is, do you also assess for involuntary exposure to substances like pesticides, household cleaners that are toxic to people with environmental illness, that sort of thing? Because there's a whole other realm of physical, behavioral, mental difficulties that can come with other toxic substances that are not considered recreational and that people may not even know they're being exposed to. Farm workers, for example, who wear clothes from the field into the house and there's a toddler crawling around on the floor. There's all kinds of pathways of exposures to that sort of toxic substance. What kind of experience and what kind of assessment do you do for that type of substance? Thank you.
I think, and that's a very good question, and, you know, it's interesting. It's when you look at the field of, I think it's looking at geology. We look at teratogenetic substances. So you look at, you know, agricultural teratogens. You're looking at industrial teratogens like lead. You're looking at, like you said, recreational teratogens that might be more voluntary in nature. I don't even think the research, some of the articles in, that I've read through in the research has been able to piece that out from an epidemiological study of how we separate this and how we look at etiology and cause. I mean, if you look at the different research bodies, there are certain, we know about lead, we know about, there is some support for herbicides and pesticides, and then we know about prenatal exposure. The reality is on the a lot of the histories that we're getting on the kids right now, it's like, you know, we don't know where they've lived or what they've been, where they've been that may have been, where they may have been exposed to those. I think it's a good question. It's something we need to consider and think of. And you highlighted that. But, you know, a lot of times, at least with the kids we see, we don't know exactly, you know, especially some of the kids have, you know, that are in foster care, we don't know exactly where, you know, where they lived, whether they lived in an agricultural community or a, but we can, go ahead.
If you have ways of asking about personal substance use habits, there's certainly, I think there should be some resources to help you devise ways of questioning about exposure to involuntary substances, whether they be household cleaners, the type of paint used in the house, or occupational things that the parents may come in with. So, again, I think it's a matter of developing protocols for asking the questions. And
okay.
So I just raise it as an area of concern because I know that not all poisoning is voluntary.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's correct.
Mr. Arnold, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Since the methamphetamine was the highest on that graph for you, I wonder if you could talk a little more about what is known about its effects, you know, if a mother's been using it while she's pregnant.
You know, that's a good question. And when you think about it, and I think it's, I can only answer with a question, is like, what's the process that's involved in developing meth and exposure? It's when we talk about teratogens, I mean, there's a whole host of potential causes of exposure to the fetus. You have the whole issue of the chemical teratogens that's used in the cooking process. You have a, we don't know if it, is it a direct feed from the mother to the fetus in utero if they're, they may not even be using, but they may be breathing the substances of the cook-off. I mean, if we're having, if police and people that are going and having to go in hazmat gear to work with the you know, to make sure that for the cleanup, one can only assume what the mother, the even the children, that the 2 to 5 year olds that are, that might be in the walking around touching the substances, what they've been exposed to. It creates a, and I don't know the exact answer, to be honest with you. I'm trying to, I think it's a research question. That research, it's hard to control a research study on that because there's so many potentially contributing variables that might contribute to not just the meth substance alone, but all the other teratogenic substances that might be contributing to that. I don't know how you would separate that to tease it down just to the meth. It's a good question. Only we can, what we can try to do is kind of look at the other chemical cousin to meth, which might be cocaine, and figure out what the research says on what cocaine exposure is, and then try to infer what meth, the results of meth might be for exposure. But it's a very good question. So I think that's kind of where we're at right now. And I hope I answered your question. So.
Well, thank you very much for being here and for giving us this interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Dr. Hilton, Alan Hilton, from from the San Luis Obispo Special Education Local Plan Area. Get that all out. You're going to give us a presentation on the educational point of view. So we really appreciate your being here tonight, and welcome, and thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking. I'm the director of the CELPA, but we're getting this in. So the purple handout is a little description of what the CELPA is. And I noticed that I brought an old handout. The purple is an old handout with the old data in it, but it does give a description of the CELPA there, so it'll serve that purpose at least. And basically, every school district within the state has to be within a CELPA, a special ed local plan area, and we happen to be a county-wide one. So I work for the 11 superintendents in the county. I guess the best description is to provide an umbrella kind of oversight and support system for special education. So enough selling my job. Thank you. Thank you for giving that up. And this presentation, I try to give you a little bit of data and kind of the facts or the information that is the basis that we operate on, and then at the end of it, a little discussion of what the challenges we're facing in the field of autism. So basically, there's an ed code section that describes what autism is, and that's different than descriptions that you'd find in the DSM-4 or other somewhat more medically oriented definitions. I think it contains many of the same components, but it's a definition that also includes the impact on learning. And so for a student to be eligible as a student with autism within the educational system, it takes one or more of the behaviors that are listed there on your sheet: an inability to use oral language, a history of withdrawal, inappropriate dealings with objects or adults. An example of that is an autistic student may take a caregiver's hand and use it as a wrench to take an attachment off, say, a play sink or something like that, instead of either finding a wrench to use or asking for that to be done or doing it themselves. They would then use the person's hand as a wrench. And that's just an example of inappropriate use of objects or people. There's an obsession with sameness, and at the same time, a whole lot of resistance to any sort of change. So changing a schedule during a day may throw a child off if there's no pre-warning to it. Often we find that parents and teachers, decide to do something different. That may cause outbreaks, tantruming, and so on. And then, let's see, resistance to controls, and that ties into some of that sameness. It's an issue of controlling the individual child, controlling their own environment. And then self-stimulation and ritualistic behavior. And an example of that might be light filtering, rocking, those kind of things. Or putting a row of items the same way every time they come into the classroom. And it may have nothing to do directly with them. We'll say that certain toys are on a shelf. Student may come in and have to arrange those before they can go to their desk. So a variety of somewhat unique behaviors. And the other thing that happens is that there is a range
of cognitive ability in this group of children. So we see from pretty seriously cognitively involved to very high functioning. And we're now referring to autism as more than just a specific syndrome, but a set of behaviors, it's a continuum, yeah. It's a continuum of involvement. And these students, the higher functioning students, have been reported to go to college, and I've met students in their 20s or individuals in their 20s who have graduated from college, but who in earlier life were defined as having autism. Okay. For 0 to 3 year olds, we are under a different set of laws in education. From 3 to 21, we use one set of laws, and from 0 to 3, we use a different set in California. And the definition, or autism, falls under a condition, has a known etiology, basically, that would result in developmental delay. So the assessment for those children, for children 0 to 3, comes from the outside environment, often from the medical profession, but may come from psychologists also. And if autism is then defined outside of education, then education accepts that as a possible known etiology and would provide services 0 to 3. And you'll see one of the challenges that we have is when parents or families move from the 0 to 3 services to 3 to 21 services, the law and the rights within that system change, and that becomes a challenge. So there have been a couple of very good articles in the Trib over the past few months that have been pretty factual, and this data, I think, is the data that they used in one of the articles. In 1991, we had one student identified as having autism in the whole county. Right in 2006, this is December data, so we don't have the 2007 data until this December, but we have 201 students with autism, and you know the trend line's pretty clear there. And there's no sign that the number's going down. I mean, with school starting again, we've actually seen more students than we had previously. So, couple of explanations to that. One, the emphasis in the media and in society in general has turned towards autism, and autism has become a favorable syndrome. We saw this with attention deficit back in the 80s, where everybody wanted their child to have attention deficit disorder as opposed to a behavior disorder or even a learning disability. But so that's one part of it. Another part is there has been an expansion of the true definition of what autism is. I taught students with autism in the 70s, and those students were all severely involved, severely cognitively involved. We didn't use to identify within the educational system within this state the higher functioning group that we now refer to as Asperger's. They often would either fall in different categories or be left for interventions from the family or be left to be kind of the funny looking child in school. Many of the behaviors that you see were present in students who are not identified and not placed in the special ed system. So we've seen an expansion of the definition, a real awareness throughout the community and throughout the educational system of the variety of symptoms that you may see, and so more students are being identified. I'd love to go to the point of saying, and there were different doses or different shots given to children. There have been changes in what the food additives, but there's no research that really defines the cause of autism. So at this point, the numbers are going up. The numbers are going up nationwide, but we don't have a picture of what is actually causing that increase other than the two factors I just mentioned. Okay, services for students within this county. We kind of break services apart and have to a, even a stronger degree until just recently. Services for, I need to go back one slide, I think. Or not. Services for infant to three-year-old, and then we break high-functioning and low-functioning for the older students. And once again, that's on just how the student functions in the environment. Right now, 0 to 3 services are provided by the County Office of Education. An individual service plan is written for the student. And there are services for the family and the child. Services are provided in the home or in a center. As the children approach 3, center-based becomes kind of a natural setting because they're going to be entering preschool. But primarily the younger children are served in the home or in a park or wherever that child might be. Whatever might be a natural setting. The regional center provides non-educational services such as respite and so on to these families also. So they're getting, the 0 to 3 population is getting services from both directions. And that model actually can continue and does to some extent continue as we move to the older students. 3 to 9, and we make a break in this county at 9, and we're starting to step away from that. Prior to the time I got here, there was the thought made if you had excellent intervention for children from 3 to 9, then they would be cured, or at least their characteristics would be lessened to such an extent that they wouldn't need specialized autism services. And we're recognizing that that's not the case and that they continue to need services even after 9. We still have, to some extent, a model that changes somewhat at 9, but that's going away this year. So the districts serve the higher functioning students and provide a variety of support services for those students. Generally, those students are in regular classrooms. The COE has started traditionally as the group that was serving, or the group of professionals that were serving all students with autism. And by July of this coming year, they will only serve the more severe population. Which is parallel with what the county office does for other populations besides autism. So, let's see, what have I missed here? We use NPA, non-public agency support, for both higher functioning and lower functioning students within the schools. This is to bolster the service package that we're able to provide. And a number of students may not be eligible for Tri-County services after they go over age three. It just depends. Students with intensive needs are served by the county office and will continue to be served by the county office. Maximum class sizes are 13 to 15, with the adult-to-student ratio being 1 to 3. In the higher-functioning classes, you see often students placed in inclusionary classes where they're with students without disabilities. In the COE classes, those classes would be with other students with disabilities. Also, non-public agency support is provided, and most of those students are eligible for services from Tri-County. We kind of have a county-wide approach for 3 to 21. If you went out and looked at classes that students with autism were in, you'd see a teacher, one to two classroom aides. In other words, those are assigned to the classroom. The teacher pretty well determines what their activities will be. And the one to two varies with how large the class is. So the larger classes will have two. And in some cases, we'll have three classroom aides. And then trained autism aides assigned to specific students to do specific tasks related to autism. And then an autism supervisor or program specialist who supervises those additional aides. And then a PhD level non-public agency person supervising, providing oversight and training for the whole package, so to speak. So curriculum and instruction. Basically, all students in the state of California are required to be in a standards-based curriculum. The more involved those students are, the more modified that curriculum can be, but it's still supposed to be parallel to the standards-based curriculum. So curriculum comes from there. However, with students with autism, we add a lot of stuff, and we use significantly different instructional methods than we do with other students that have disabilities. So from No Child Left Behind and from the IDEA, the federal education law, we're required to use research-based methods of instruction. And for students with autism, that's basically applied behavioral analysis, direct instruction, discrete trial teaching, and then a communication system called PECS, and then the TEACH. There are some other structured activities or structured instructional approaches that do have some research base. We're seeing a program called Pivotal Response come out of Santa Barbara, for example, and it's being used in some of our classrooms. But often when a student is first enrolled in an autism program, the curriculum is how to learn and how to attend as opposed to the standards curriculum. And as soon as they can, then the attending becomes to the standards and to the standards-based curriculum, and it moves more into the traditional curriculum. The other thing that is very very much required and is done very much more with students with autism than with other students is database monitoring of behavior and progress. With some students, you're looking at daily or ongoing responses as the level of monitoring. So instead of giving a test, the test is responding to certain stimuli, and the aide is sitting there taking data on each response, so that you see these students build up big packets of data, and then the data is used to make decisions, and that's where we use the autism supervisors and the NPA PhD NPA person to review that and look at program changes and so on. The other thing these students often require is occupational therapy and speech and some other related services, a lot to do with sensory stimulation and overstimulation of the senses, and the OTs do a lot in that area to reduce that, saying not to overstimulate them. Challenges, it's interesting to hear the challenges faced by Martha's Place and hear the statement that, you know, these are state and national problems. Well, there are state and national problems here that we're faced within this county. The increasing numbers of students in autism, there's at least a weekly article in the national media on the number of the increases. An over willingness by non-educational professionals to identify students with autism. We are seeing that. And it's probably done in an effort to try and help students, but it is filling up our system and draining resources from students that actually have autism. And it becomes a real point of contention when districts do assessment and the student doesn't appear to have autism, and an outside psychologist, for example, does an assessment or reviews input from the parent and says, oh, this child has autism, they're somewhere on the autism spectrum, which is the word I was trying to think of before, autism spectrum. That is a real challenge for us. The competition between NPAs in this county, we've had an NPA come in from Santa Barbara County, and that NPA has testified in court against some of our districts about the level of training and support, and in some of the cases it has been a little somewhat self-centered. These non-public agencies make money off of providing services. And so if they can make a case that their services are better than another NPA, then they end up hired or they end up in a settlement agreement, which that sort of competition is really not healthy and is expensive for the districts. Limited resources in the county. We're one of the lowest funded counties. We're in the lowest third of counties within the state for special ed funding, but required to follow all the regulations and all the legal decisions for providing services for students with autism. The other thing is we're in a declining enrollment county, and most of the districts are declining enrollment. And the way education in general is funded within the state, you do all right if you're growth, and if you're stagnant or going down, you suffer. Multiple treatment approaches and varied success. There's controversy in the field of autism, and it's often you'll find a parent or a advocate coming in and asking for a certain approach that may not be research-based, but then we end up in a disagreement and trying to work that out with the parent to explain that we use only research-proven techniques, and that although you like that approach or you may be seeing some success with it outside of the school, we generally are not willing to accept something that isn't research-based. Challenges for our schools: difficulty in maintaining trained staff, the availability of a population to work at the salaries we're able to pay, especially in the aid population. And if you'll remember, I pointed out there were a large number of aides in these classrooms working with students with autism. The availability of people and at that level and their willingness to stay for any committed period of time is certainly a challenge. High educational costs of students with autism. we're looking at easily double the cost on some of these students compared to other students in the special ed system. And an argument could be made that perhaps all the students need that level of service. Students with autism receiving more services than other students, that's the same kind of concept there. And then a willingness of parents to go to fair hearings, that's certainly their right, but we have seen with this population a greater willingness to fight the battle in at the state hearing level as opposed to try and resolve it through local mediation and so on. So all of those challenges are out there. A number of them have come about just because of historical factors within within the state, how we sit, how we're funded, and so on. But there are a lot of employee time within the school districts being directed at autism training, autism support, and working with the parents of that population. So I'm going to end it there and ask if you have questions.
Commissioner O'Dell.
Welcome, Alan.
Thank you, Dee.
Of these 201 autism in the last statistic, are they spread throughout all the districts? And
Yeah, I believe all of our districts have at least one student with autism. You have to remember that some of our districts are pretty small.
Good.
Pleasant Valley, for example, and so on. But it's fairly evenly spread. You don't see a difference between the north and the south of the grade or anything like that, percentage-wise.
Are they part of the special education of each district then?
Yes. The district has the responsibility, and if they choose to ask the county office to serve the student, and the student then fits into the range of services that the county office does, then the county office takes them, but they still belong to that district.
Commissioner Hetherington. What generally is the outcome with all of the extra help that the students are getting? Do they attain a graduation status? I mean, what do you hope for the best outcome for this population?
Yeah, and because it is a range from fairly highly cognitively impaired to fairly high cognitively skilled, the expectations are different for students. So the higher functioning students, we're looking at and working with parents to work towards graduation. And the students with lower cognitive abilities, we're looking towards them transitioning probably primarily through county office programs, being served until they're 22, and then moving into the adult services world, primarily tri-counties, and having supported adulthood. But even with those students, we're looking at growth every year for students. So that with all that intensive service and so on, that they improve from where they are. So each one is individual, though. So
the Asperger's part, is that readily identified early on as far as if they're high-functioning autistic? Or?
A couple of things seem to happen fairly consistently with all of the students. So I started to answer maybe the wrong question here, but it's often reported that the kids start to talk and then stop, and that you start to see they seemed pretty normal as babies, and then all of a sudden you're seeing gaze aversion and things like that. And that becomes an indicator. So identification can happen pretty early with these kids. Now, what you see is the higher cognitive ability kids are learning how to talk, or they're learning words. They may not construct sentences correctly, as opposed to a lower functioning child at the same age may not have any language. So the cognitive ability appears to increase the learning capability. I mean, that's a fairly safe assumption that we see, for example, within the mentally retarded population, that lower cognitive ability students with just mental retardation develop speech slower and more limitedly. So with the Asperger's type child, they're developing a lot of the skills, but their social skills aren't very good. So a lot of focus is on social skills, a lot of focus on speech improvement, those kind of things. So yes, fairly early you can tell, at least to some extent, how much impact cognitive ability is going to have. Excuse me.
I have, I think, one, maybe two more questions. When you talk about other people diagnosing these children, are you excluding the medical profession, or are you including them in those people that are identifying it, maybe aren't appropriate to identify it?
No, I think what I was trying to say is that identification takes place outside of education, not on educational standards, number one. And then two, for example, for a psychologist to identify a child with autism, that may be appropriate, but what's happened is we've seen some inappropriate diagnosis because of lack of either lack of knowledge of the syndrome or lack of willingness to put the time in and really do a complete assessment. So that's what I was trying to say by that. So it's not inappropriate for those people to do that diagnosis, because once you have that sort of diagnosis, you get services not only in the educational system but in other systems. So, but it's inappropriate if you don't use the standards that are there, and we see that at times.
Okay, my last question. Are there environmental assessments once these children are diagnosed? I mean, do you go and ask if their parents have experimented with drugs or if they drink alcohol? I mean, the same triggers that we're looking at fetal alcohol syndrome. I mean,
yeah, really not. And I'll give you maybe a pat explanation of that. I don't know. We end up in education having to serve the child no matter what the cause was. So even with, I said early on that, you know, we don't really know the cause of autism. For educators, it doesn't matter. The child's there. They exhibit a set of characteristics or symptoms, and we have to deal with the child that's there and provide services for that child. So the cause would be nice to know, and it actually often helps parents to understand what's going on. And I would say that ultimately, I think within my lifetime, we will know the cause or the causes. I would guess there are several causes of autism. But once again, for education, we have to serve the child as they are.
Oh, I had a question. Are the parents involved in the education process?
In varying degrees. Often we see highly involved parents with this population. The parents have, we've been involving, Tri-Counties in education, actually in the three counties, have been involved in a two-year task force where we've involved parents kind of looking at the overall picture of education, but individually parents are often extremely involved. And of course, in the education process, we have a mandatory yearly individual educational plan that's written. And it can be rewritten in less than a year also. But in that process, goals and objectives are developed for the child, and parents take part in that and have a lot of input to that. So, and then often what we see are communication notebooks, work summaries, and so on, going home either daily or on a weekly basis to parents because of their level of involvement. And a lot of parents are doing home programs besides the educational program. So the child goes to school for a certain amount of hours, and then the parents are, as the children get older at least, are carrying out programs that they have learned from outside people or that they've learned from the teachers that continue the growth of the child. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of involvement of parents.
Appears there are questions from the audience if you want to come forward and ask your question.
Thank you, Chairman Ans. Thank you, Dr. Hilton. A follow-up sort of on what Pam was saying. I realize your job is education, not research, but I just wondered if you are aware of any of the research that is going on in this field, if you could give us a short summary of what you know on that. Thank you.
Well, yeah. They've been looking at a lot of things, and one of them is the, and Dr. Mays can probably say this better, can get at these things better than I can, but at the series of immunizations that are given children, and the chemical that kind of holds the viruses or whatever are in those together, they've looked at that. They've looked at exposure by parents to different chemicals, and they saw in some of the early recently that somebody did a retrospective study and saw in some of the early samples that six out of seven of the early group of first identified kids with autism parents had been involved in some chemical that had to do with agricultural spraying or killing of insects, but and they're starting to use brain scan technology, and I think that's going to paint some pictures, at least on help us instructionally on how the brain's functioning differently than what you see in it traditionally with the brain. But those are a few of the things I've read lately, but nothing is coming out with definitive answers at this point.
But what about heredity?
We don't have at least anything that I've read on samples of for example parents with autism that have children with autism. I haven't.
Well, in our greater family, we have that.
Do you?
A father with autism, and he has a son.
Yeah. Well, and I've often thought there's some genetic tie in there, but I don't know of the research that relates to that.
Go ahead, Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and thank you. Very interesting presentation. Two questions. First question, have you made any contacts with county emergency services, having stated that disruption of routine is very difficult for people with autism? That is a special population then relative to natural disasters where everyone's routine is disrupted and they may need special help and support. So has there been contact with and planning with relative to that population? My second question is, has there been research on the increasing sensory distraction in our environment? In other words, in my own lifetime, the world has become so much more noisier. Homes and schools have become more and more filled with electronic equipment of different kinds that makes all kinds of causes all kinds of distractions. Has there been research on both in the school and home environments going back to sort of the way things were earlier, minimizing those squawking and beeping and bleeping and vibrating fluorescent and all the other things that are now part of our environment, something more of a Waldorf approach to education, perhaps, where the environment itself is not. I think all of us are under an avalanche of sensory overstimulation, and it's a miracle that some of us are able to handle it as well as we do, but we have a special population that doesn't necessarily have the same immunities, and so I just wondered what you thought about that, as well as the emergency services question. Thank you.
Well, there, I'll answer the second one first. A lot of the one of the interventions that's used with students with autism is a relates to a sensory diet and so on. So they do look at that, and it has been fairly successful. And one of the regulation systems for kids that we try to get them to recognize is to almost time themselves out into less stimulation. So that there has been some research on that, and there is some intervention that goes on in that area. As for the contacting the emergency response groups, not that I know of. However, within the schools, they do practice evacuations, for example, and they do practice earthquake drills and so on. So these students are exposed to that, and there's generally a feeling that there are enough adults in the environment to help the student through that, and if the student did have to be evacuated, that can be done.
Go ahead and come on forward, Dr. Holliffield.
Thank you. Just, it's more of a, I think, a comment to your question about the exposure piece, and kind of, it's interesting. There is, if you think of a behavioral overlap between children who've been prenatally exposed to alcohol and autism, there is some overlap. So if you think about a Venn diagram, and you have autism over here from a diagnostic behavioral presentation, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder here, there is some gray area of overlap. And sometimes that occurs with the sensory issues. Sometimes that occurs more with sometimes the aggression, kind of the difficulty of changes in routine, the mental shifting component. But what really are markers for autism from a clinical diagnostic standpoint is early on, which is language and communication and social interaction are predictors of really outcomes, what we've been able to find. And I think Dr. Hilton brought up some good points about diagnostic criteria. If you look at an educational diagnosis for autism, it's going to be different from a psychiatric diagnosis of autism. Educational diagnosis, and I think I'm correct, this is called autistic-like in a way. And so really it's kind of more generalized and holistic, whereas a psychiatric diagnosis has criteria that you check off of meeting. So one occurs more if children who are diagnosed with autism or any special education diagnosis is the impact on educational performance. Whereas, you know, a psychiatric diagnosis is going to consider that, but look at other areas. And it comes into the whole issue of really kind of looking at where, you know, again, going back to the 0 to 5 population about early intervention, both from an autistic diagnostic view as well as just from children in general.
I'll just kind of, this is my time, Joe.
Okay. there was a question about that.
The one thing that Dr. Chasnoff talked to us about when he was here is that very clearly, in their clinic, they were able to identify students that had been identified as autistic who were actually drug and alcohol impacted. And that was a very positive statement for the superintendents, because they were looking at, you know, this growing population and the costs. Although the drug and alcohol afflicted population requires a lot of supervision and a lot of assistance also. So.
Well, thank you very much for a nice presentation. We will take a 5-minute break, and I mean 5 minutes, and then resume our agenda. Thank you.
Anyway, yes, tonight I do have a 3-year report and also an update of what's been happening with community health centers of the Central Coast. First of all, my name is Larry Bacuse, and I work with community health centers. And as you give you a little brief history, in 2003, the County Board of Supervisors voted to close the General Hospital. And at that time, Slo County contracted with my organization for physician services with the local Turnham group. And at that time, there was, you know, before the 2003, 2000, before all that, there was some major concerns of the medical community, physicians, the hospitals, regarding the inappropriate ER visits and just some other things, some access care. So basically, the county looked at that and... And then in 2004, and up to now, there was gave birth to a partnership. The Slo County contracted with CHC to operate the county family care centers and also the pharmacy. And this partnership actually have saved the taxpayers quite a bit of money. As you have seen in my slides, but the goals of this partnership was to control costs, increase access for low-income patients, provide a medical home for Slo County residents, establish a health care safety net for primary care, reduce inappropriate emergency visits in local ER hospitals, expand service hours, and area, or service area, and ensure quality of care. This slide here is basically a projection made by the county when all this was happening, and they kind of projected what they would be spending if they had these clinics. This has actually been published before, so I didn't make this up. But if you look at 2004, 2005 and 6, 2006 and 7, their projected cost was 8.5, 9.2 million, and 10.4. And when they partnered up with the county, with CHC, we got 6.1 million. This is the pharmacy plus the clinic contract plus a startup amount. So that's why it's 6.1. The next year was a 5.3. There was an increase, the CPI index. And then in 2006 and 7, it's 5.5. So you can just take this, you subtract that. And one good friend used to say to me, Larry, it's just basic mathematics. Just subtract the amount that was projected and the amount that we are actually being given to run these clinics. And want you to note that in the projected, there was no new or enhanced services included, whereas in the two, there, increased hours, more clinics, these are all part of that contract. This is a snapshot of the bottom line, or what we have over expenses. Again, if you, and there's a lot of math here, but if you look at it, in 2004, 2005, we had our total expenses of about $31 million. And over excess, we had 1.6. In 2005, 2006 fiscal year, we had $35 million expense. Over was 2.0 million. And this is a pre-audit, before the audit came out, we have about $40 million in expenses and a little over $500,000 for over revenue, over expense. And I put a little notation here. Based on a 365 days per year basis, CHC's daily cash need is about $108,000 per day. Currently, CHC has about 24 days cash in reserve accounts. So federal government, as you all know, we have a grant with the federal government, and they basically recommend that we have a 60-day needs in cash reserve. So as you see, we're half there. This is a progress report in regards to our the number of visits. This is one of the goals. The goals is to increase the visits, you know, number of patients we see or each year. And if you notice in 2003, these are all actual numbers on the graph there. In 2003, this is before the county partnership, okay? So we had, it was 107,000 visits. And if you zoom up to now, it's what, 255,000. You know, that's, you know, we actually, it's 100% increase or more. This one here is the number of patients, unduplicated patients that we have. Again, if you look at the numbers, we've actually doubled. We had 25,000 when we were on our own, and now with the county, we're at 54,000. This is the area that we cover. Again, part of the goal is to, you know, be all over the place. And if you notice, we are in both counties, Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo. And these are basically all the clinics. This is the area where we have clinics. This slide here tells you the green is the recent clinics that we have established. If you notice up in San Miguel, we recently put a clinic up that way. It's a part-time clinic. Morro Bay, we have Morro Bay 1, Morro Bay 2. We have a new clinic now in Oceana since I last reported to you all. And if you notice the two, those are our dental services that we have throughout the county. We have a clinic up in Templeton. We're going to establish one up in, here in San Luis Obispo. We've got Santa Maria and then also in Lompoc. How do we increase this access? Well, we have free transportation. We provide transportation to patients from their home to our clinic and the clinic back to their home. And sometimes we do that with specialty care. Sometimes we have to, well, we can't find a specialist here in San Luis Obispo. We take that patient to Santa Maria. We cross the, we believe in no borders. Put it that way. Expanded hours, weekend. We have extended weekend hours and also evening hours. We are open from 5 to 7. This is a good time to catch a lot of patients, you know, a lot of people who, you know, work 9 to 5, then come into our clinic from 5 to 7. We do a lot of outreach. We work with certain departments of the county, also with EOC, a lot of different organizations, and work with them with health fairs. In our clinics, we have walk-in capability. That means if a patient walks in and they need to be seen, we will see them. We will also educate that patient. It's not a good idea to walk in. You may have to wait, but we do allow them to walk in, and we will see those patients. We will not turn them away. And the other thing is we have more clinics throughout the county. If you notice on the slide, we're all over. and we also have a sliding fee scale for folks who let's say they work and they don't have they don't make enough money. We have a little scale where they can pay a certain amount and be seen. And through this last 3 years, we've actually brought in more physicians and other healthcare providers. We also use LCSWs, licensed clinical social workers, and we use health educators a lot. So we've been bringing quite a few of those in the last 3 years into our system. And, you know, back then we had about 100 employees, and now we're at 408. And how do we ensure quality of care? Well, you know, we have to turn in a report to the county. And, you know, I put an A on there because basically if we get less than that, you know, someone will tell me. Anyway, we have a CPA audit, an independent financial audit that's built into the contract that basically says that we have an accountant comes in and do a financial audit. That's been very good. We have a patient satisfaction survey that we do routinely. And we are also going to be having an external agency come in to do a satisfaction survey that we would, you know, have them just go to certain clinics and do the survey either by telephone or by mail, which is very good. It kind of gives you a better picture of what the patients' needs are and what some of their complaints are, or, you know, just try to make things better for them. And we're also JCO accredited. Oops. Can you go back? Okay. There you go. These are the regulatory affiliates that we have, National Association of Community Health Centers. I don't know if I remember telling you all this, but the community health centers is throughout the United States. There's about 1,000 of us all over the United States. And it all kind of began about 40 years ago. And the National Association of Community Health Centers is an association where if you have any issues or legislative problems, you can go there. So you'll see some of our folks actually going to these conferences to, you know, learn from other community health centers of, you know, what's going on, especially with mental health services, you know, just a whole slew of things. And as you, we also are linked with the Joint Commission, which is the JCO, California Primary Care Association, same thing. They have a lot of resources available for community health centers in the state of California. For example, when the budget was not signed, California Primary Care Association sent out a kind of a press release to all the clinics that, you know, you're going to have to heads up, the budget hadn't been signed, and so you may have some issues with cash flow. And HRSA. HRSA is the is a federal. Actually, it's a branch of the Bureau of Public Primary Health Care, and this is where we get our grants from. One of the things that we do internally is we want to make sure that our patients are getting the best care, and one of the things is to join a national chronic care collaborative. This is, again, part of the community health center's way to kind of assess or manage these types of chronic illness. For example, diabetes, we are in the middle of doing that survey. Asthma is next. We have depression and cardiovascular. And these are the same type of diseases that, you know, all the community health centers are actually doing surveys and working with the National Chronic Care Collaborative to ensure that we're all on the same page. So that's really good. Summary, the last 3 years, the chronic goals have been met. We've noticed, I don't have data, but we have noticed that there have been a decrease in inappropriate ERs. Some of the things that we do out there is that we have meetings in our centers and sometimes outside the centers where we actually invite ER docs or other agencies just to see if they have any issues, concerns, patient problems. And we found that to be very good, where instead of having those things come to here, we can at least work with them at the clinic level. We have a health center manager at all our clinics that are competent enough to work out some of these issues, and they can also work out with the hospital ER docs or some of the different agencies out there. We do still get some complaints, but, you know, hopefully each of the clinics will handle those concerns. Ongoing insurance, I just mentioned that to you. Ongoing patient satisfaction survey, same thing. And then we also increase access to the pharmacy and also radiology. And most important of all, and the reason why we're all here is, my realization is, is the patients. We're meeting the needs of the patients. And you all should be proud. Actually, you're second here as a member, because I think when all this all started, you all had a big part in all this, in making this all work. And I think you should give yourself a hand as you residents of San Luis Obispo, the Medical Society, and in the county of San Luis Obispo. But giving you a good little story, but there is a storm brewing in all this. And I'd like to just mention that. What I want you to understand that is that this storm that's brewing can threaten what we have built altogether here in the last 3 years. There is a possible reduction of the grant with the county. And this is, you know, like anything else, this is something that that the county has to really look at. And so, but I just want you to remember this, that there has been a savings that was projected by the county folks. And what I would like to do my organization is that we would like the Health Commission to support its effort to maintain the current safety net it provides and help maintain our fiscal viability. We'd like to also have you send a message to the Board of Supervisors, if you will, not to reduce our grant. And I tell you this because, when you have a reduce in monies, there's always going to be something else that's going to be reduced to compensate for that. And basically, that's what I'd like to request from you all tonight.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Are there questions from commissioners? Why am I not surprised? No, Commissioner Hetherington. I guess I was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. What is the county proposing to do, Larry?
Well, we did meet with the county, and basically there, as you all know, probably from the Board of Supervisors meeting, that they were given to kind of look at their services and you know, just the overall health agency. And as you all know, you know, CHC is part of that. And so we get concerned when there's talk about cuts or reduction. They really haven't been really specific, but they've, as far as the amount or if we are going to have one, it's a potential. But we're kind of like proactive type people. We want to kind of just, you know, let you all know what's going on. And I'm pretty sure, I think reading from your minutes from the last commissioner's view, there was a list that was going to be out. And I know we're not on that list, but I guess we're looking at to just preempt something that if you know, it may not happen.
How long was the contract that you signed with the county?
It's 5 years. This is our third year. We're going into our fourth year now.
And what's the revision after 5 years? I mean, what will be revisited?
We're talking with the county now. We're looking at the contract. Where you know, we'll, I guess, and before a year, or this at the end of this year, and we will come to the table and look at the contract, revise it, our hope is to extend the contract.
You'll keep us abreast, I'm sure.
Yes. Any other comments?
Commissioner O'Dell.
Do you have any threats from a federal or state funding?
No.
That's going to remain pretty stable. Yeah. Right?
Which has been pretty good with us.
Yeah. Now, this potential cut, you're talking about next year or are you talking about the end of the contract?
It may happen within the next year.
Yeah. Even with the existing contract?
Yes. May not.
Are there any other questions? Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Greening has a question.
Eric Greening, just a comment relative to the shoe that may drop, and that is that the larger county budget picture, one of the stresses on it is that they are spending more general fund money to maintain our road system. I think we need to have the whole picture. It was devastatingly irresponsible for the governor to chop the vehicle license fee by two-thirds, have local government lose that source of revenue for road maintenance. It's irresponsible the way we now expect our transportation system, our auto-driven transportation system, to be funded from general fund and other sources than automobile user fees, gas taxes, are tiny as a proportion of the total price compared to what they are now. This is a part of the county picture. As their efforts increase with general funds in areas like roads, because of the lack of user fee revenue, it is the health of our people that suffers. So that is one more way the automobile is being permitted to destroy the health of our people. And I hope we keep the whole picture in mind, because you have weighed in on transportation issues in the past, and this is a way that they directly intersect. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. I think that just about wraps that up. Thank you again very much for being here.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Mr. Hamm with our health agency report.
Good evening. Jeff Hamm, health agency director. I intend to be brief. Dr. Bacusa's presentation is just one of the consequences or one of the reactions that I've been getting lately as I've been out talking with folks that are employees of the health agency and stakeholder groups about the board's direction. To me during the budget hearings, and we had a pretty extensive discussion at your last meeting, about actually 2 meetings ago, about this. I thought it was interesting, slide 15 or 16 or whatever towards the end there, about the storm brewing, because I couldn't agree more. There is a storm brewing. I'm getting calls from just about everybody that you can imagine wanting to express their concern about their particular program of interest, and the date that we've scheduled for the board's consideration of our staff presentation to them about the our sort of a financial status, with the financial condition that we're in and why, and the a sort of a prioritized list of possible service level reductions that they would need to direct us to implement in order to sort of adjust to a sustainable level of general fund support over years. If they didn't want to take it out of the road fund or from the sheriff or somewhere else, is November 27th. So two more health commission meetings between now and then. Getting a lot of input from employees, and we'll be incorporating their input into the development of our prioritized list. Other department heads, sheriff and probation, particularly DSS, folks who we're in business with collaboratively, you know, with regard to the services that we provide, sheriff's very concerned to see, you know, possible reduction in the level of medical care at the jail, which we don't like that either, and I'm not sure that that's a, you know, even a very cost-effective, well, none of them are really cost-effective, but hard to imagine that that would find its way very high up on the list. We didn't used to have 24-hour nursing coverage at the jail. In fact, 10 years ago or whatever, we added that not just in the interest of patient care to inmates, but as a way to avoid emergency, you know, ambulance trips, you know, to hospitals and emergency room visits and that kind of stuff. So, so far what we've told everybody is that there is no area of our almost $80 million budget that's immune from the questions that we need to ask. What would happen if we reduce the service level in this particular service? And that's the dialogue that I've begun, or that we're having with CHC leadership. Is that's why there isn't a specific proposal on the table from the health agency administration to CHC leadership about a particular dollar amount or anything. It's more of a question, just like we're engaging in a dialogue with the program managers in all of our programs. What would happen? What would the consequences be operationally, as well as financially, if the board of supervisors were to reduce its financial commitment to this program or that program? So until we have a detailed response to those kinds of questions, we're really not in a position to make any recommendations. We're not in a position where we can even identify the consequences of various decisions that the board might make about level of service. So I was reminded, as Larry was going through his presentation, that he said he didn't have any data to support what they sense is a reduced utilization of ER visits. We do have data, at least for CMSP, where we are seeing a pretty significant decline in ER visits for CMSP patients, which we presume is a result of the expanded locations and the expanded hours that primary care clinics are available to folks who had historically before that had gotten a lot of their primary care in the emergency room. So we do have some data that supports that conclusion. Only other thing I wanted to mention, and I hesitate, actually, but there's a very good chance that you probably have been reading about healthcare financing reform, AB8, the bill that was the two bills that are coming out of the Democratic leadership in each of the two houses of the state legislature. There's a chance that they could, you know, the rumor today, or not rumor, but the reports that I was getting out of CSAC, out of the County Supervisors Association and the County Health Execs Association of California, is that they're going to try and get that to the governor, out of the Senate and Assembly floors, to the governor to force him to veto it, which he's promised to do. And they're talking very seriously about a special session, even though they only have, you know, a couple days left in the regularly scheduled legislative session. So it is a little scary, at least from my perspective, to think that they might try and force a re-engineering of the state's healthcare financing system through, you know, in a special session here in the fall. Their experience in doing that kind of thing has not been good. It's a complex issue. They've been working on it for a long, long time, and they haven't done a really very good job, in my opinion, so far. So, but there's a lot going on in Sacramento relative to healthcare financing reform. Those are the only two things I wanted to touch on this evening, unless you have any questions.
Commissioner O'Dell.
Yes, on the homeless, which the governor vetoed and said take it out of Mental Health Services Act, I guess. What's the status of that? For our program, it exists today.
I don't have the numbers, but we have been working on a contingency plan that we think will provide very, very similar services to most of that population with Mental Health Services Act Prop 63 funds.
Oh. So you're doing what the governor wanted.
We're doing the only thing we think we can do.
Yeah.
It happens to be that it's what the governor and the director of the State Department of Mental Health, Stephen Mayberg, indicated that they believed as early as January, when the governor eliminated funding for AB 2034 from his budget, and everybody went. And he said, well, you have other sources of revenue that you could use for this.
I heard there was some potential action in a suit because what he did, some people think, is illegal.
Yeah, I haven't heard. We've expected all along someone to sue him or them or the state. I don't know. We hope they don't sue us. But I haven't heard anything specific about it yet.
Any other questions from commissioners? Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Moving along on the agenda here, chair update. We're now Health Commission updates. Chair update is I'd like to share with you that the Tobacco Coalition program is participating in a number of events this fall, and they are asking for volunteers to come out and support the Tobacco Coalition. On Saturday, the 15th of September, is the 23rd annual coastal cleanup at Avila Beach. On Saturday, why does it say Avila Beach? Please join. Oh, okay. It's all over the county. I guess I'm not sure then why it says please join us at Avila Beach, where we will be partnering with EcoSlow as they hold their annual beach cleanup. So,
I think there's 15 to 18 sites throughout the county.
Okay. Did everybody hear that? Commissioner Hetherington said that she thought there were 15 to 18 sites throughout the county. All right, then. And then on Saturday, September 29th, is the 17th annual San Luis Obispo Heart Walk. And coalition is also involved with that. And last but not least, local legislative district days will be scheduled during the week of October 15th through 19th. There's been, I didn't bring with me a list of tobacco legislation, but as has been reported on in the past, there's quite a number of bills making their way through the legislature regarding tobacco. Then the other entity that I'm involved with is the Obesity Task Force, and we had a meeting on September 5th, which prior to that meeting, within the last 2 months, 3 months, there were three subgroups identified and started to work on actually implementing the recommendations of the task force report. And those were the community mobilization group, and then there was a group on nutrition and a group on physical exercise. And nutrition and exercise are going to combine their meetings. We still are all working together in many ways, but I'm more familiar with the community mobilization since that I'm chairing that group along with another member of the group. And what we are doing is we're going to put out an RFP for someone professional to help us develop an image for the task force and to guide us in our media selection. And it's quite an involved RFP, but we are hoping that we're asking the respondents to do this work pro bono for the beginning, for which they will receive recognition, and hopefully then as we qualify for grant money, which is being actively sought, we'll be able to move forward with things that actually cost money. Let's see if there's anything further I really want to say about that. I guess that the gist of it is that this task force is active, it is working, and we are moving forward in trying to identify and get people mobilized to prevent childhood obesity, particularly childhood obesity. So that's the end of my report. We'll start at my right. Commissioner O'Dell.
I have no report. The Mental Health Board did not meet in August.
Commissioner Horn.
Yes. Excuse me. I went to Children's Services Network. They're in the process of redefining what they are going to do. The first papers have come out, and there'll be some tweaks to that, and then they will set up the way that they interact with the community and health services that are provided to children in the community.
Commissioner Hetherington.
Domestic Violence Task Force meets next week. They only meet every other month, so nothing to report.
Commissioner Massey.
Nothing to report.
And Commissioner Grena.
Nothing to report.
Okay, then how about committee reports? Let's see. Legislative Committee Chair is not here. Commissioner Hetherington, could you help us out here?
We met with Jeff Hamm. Thank you, Jeff, very much for holding our hand through the next legislative process. We're going to be revamping our timelines and getting some hands-on education from Mr. Hamm about how to proceed to be effective.
And didn't we set a standard time for meeting every month? I've forgotten what it was, but we did set one, I thought. You forgot?
The last Wednesday, I think.
It's the last Wednesday of the month. Thank you. Okay. Community education. Commissioner Hetherington?
Nothing to report.
Okay. Budget chairman is not here, or is the nominating chair here, but I don't think either of those committees have met in the last month.
There is going to be a nominating committee next Monday, I think.
Oh, all right.
It's Friday.
Yeah, isn't it Monday?
It's Friday.
Friday? Oh.
Friday 28th.
Oh. Oh, I better look at my calendar.
All right. So we have a nominating committee meeting coming up, so we can expect a report at the next commission meeting. Now, on prospective future items, for next month, one of the things we thought we might have was the CHC update, but we got that this month. So we were talking about possible hospital reports from the CEOs at the local hospitals, trauma center designation, CalSTAR services. And I guess I was interested to know what the nursing update might be, and what is the situation with nursing in the county, and maybe even what's happening at Cuesta College in terms of their graduating nurses, and are those nurses staying here or going away? Are there any other suggestions? Okay. Well, we'll fill up the agenda, I'm sure, between now and next month. And then, of course, we're looking forward to really intense meeting in November on domestic violence, not to be missed. If there is nothing else, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
Moved and seconded to adjourn, and we are adjourned.